6. We're looking at verses 27 through 47, which is the Sermon on the Mount. Luke's account is much shorter than Matthew. Much, much shorter, as a matter of fact. Matthew takes chapters 5, 6, and 7 for the sermon, and Luke only gives us chapter 6, beginning at verse 20 down through verse 49. But basically, it does break into two parts, where we stopped last time, which was when chapter 6, verse 27. And the two parts basically are, number one, a commendation of love. 6:27 through 38. And you can see how it is commended. Verse 27, I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you. Coming down to verse 32, if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? And that continues down through verse 38. Verse 39 is broken up when it says he spoke a parable to them, and the heart of that parable revolves about forgetting about the log that is in your eye because you're looking for the speck that is in someone else's eye. So if commendation of love is 6:27 through 38, then condemnation of hypocrisy is in 6:39 down through the end of the chapter. And we'll get into that tonight. But we start now tonight at commendation of love, chapter 6, 27 through 38. And the first thing to note in this particular section is this. Notice the connection and use of two words. The word love and the words do good. And the first thing to note is simply to see how these words are used side by side in this section. Love, obviously, is an attitude toward another or toward others. Do good, obviously, focuses not on attitude but on action. And notice that throughout the entire context, these two words are made very, very important. For example, in 6:27. But I say to you who hear, love, attitude, your enemies, do good, and that's an action. Coming down to 32, verse 32, and if you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For sinners love those that love them. Emphasis on attitude. Verse 33, if you do good to those who do good to you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners do the same. So if verse 32 is attitude of love, verse 32 is action of, or verse 33 is action term in terms of doing good things. Verse 35, love your enemies, do good. Now what should we make out of the connection of love and do good inseparably forged together in this particular context? And I think it teaches us one of the first basic things that is shot through in the New Testament, which is simply this. Love always shows itself in action, not words. Love shows itself in action or actions. Or we could put it a different way. Love is not words. Love is action. Love is not what you say. Love is what you do. Let me, keeping your finger here, show a verse that makes that very clear, 1 John 3:16, as to how love can be identified by action, not by words. 1 John 3:16. Love and action is so tied together that John is going to teach us that if you want to see love, look for what the person did. Look for action, then you find love. You do not look for love and then find action. It's the other way around. You look for the actions and then you discover love. 1 John chapter 3, verse 16. We know love by this. And that's pretty specific as to how love can be identified. We know love by this, that he laid down his life for us. Notice, love is identified by what he did for us, and that is the teaching of Luke chapter 6. Now, going back to that passage, commendation to love comes first. Second, when you come down to chapter 6 and verse 27, you have something very revolutionary that the scribes didn't teach and most of his audience had never heard, because the words of verse 27 were contrary to the teaching of the scribes of that day. They had to be shocked when he said in verse 27, "I say to you who hear, love your enemies and do good to those who hate you." First of all, the command to love that they were familiar with was found in Leviticus 19 and verse 18. And again, keeping your finger here, let's go to that and I'll show you how they interpreted that verse differently than Jesus did. Leviticus 19, 18. Reading the verse, and then let me give you the interpretation which the scribes made of it. It says, "You shall not take vengeance, nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself." Rabbinic and Jewish and scribal interpretation took that verse, and they interpreted it in terms of limitation. It was interpreted in terms of limitation. Being interpreted in terms of limitation means this. It says love your neighbor only. A limited interpretation. And they certainly did not include in that those that hate you. It was you shall not hate your fellow countrymen, verse 17. Verse 18, again, you shall not bear a grudge against the sons of your people. Limited interpretation, but you shall love your neighbor. And that does not include, in fact, the word neighbor is often used in the Old Testament for a friend. Love your neighbor, love your friend as yourself, I am the Lord. And therefore, the limited interpretation given to them was that. And therefore, the interpretation given was very simply this. It is toward fellow Israelites that this command is spoken. It is about fellow Israelites and those who are friends or those who deserved it. And that was typical rabbinic interpretation. That's what the scribes taught. We'll see it a little bit later on in Matthew chapter 5 through 7. Where he specifically says, here's what they teach. They teach you to hate your enemies and you're to love your friends. That was their interpretation of this particular section. Notice, going back to Luke 6:32. Jesus alludes to this fact. And he says, if you love those who love you. And that's the way they understood that Old Testament command. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? For even sinners love those who love them. And therefore, he's going to attack this particular interpretation and give it a turn that they had never seen. Now, from this, he moves to a couple of practical illustrations of love. Practical illustration of loving one's enemies. And that takes up Luke 6, verses 28 through 30. Number one, verse 28. Bless those who bless you. Pray for those who mistreat you. And so the term is, you must learn to wish and pray for those who mistreat you. Must learn to wish and to pray for those who mistreat you. And that is the first concrete illustration of what does it mean to love your enemies. Now, what does that mean? Several things. Number one, it means this. It means that we do not repay sin in kind. We do not repay sin in kind. And if we think that that is not the teaching that we should respond to, again, keeping your finger here, 1 Peter 3:9. 1 Peter 3:9 explains even better what it means not to repay evil in kind. To be sinned against does not legitimize sinning against. Now, let's grant it, to be sure that we're all in the same boat and you don't think that I am preaching to you. All of this is contrary to my nature. Is it not contrary to yours? Because my nature says, poke my eye out and I'll poke both of yours out. And you think that much the same way too. And we do want to guide through that a Christian is not to be a wimp. It doesn't mean he is walked upon. And we'll develop that a little bit later. But it does mean we don't repay in kind. And that's very clear. And if you think, well, that's the Sermon on the Mount and it doesn't count for anybody else, it only counts for those to whom it was spoken, then go to the book of 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 9. And he's very emphatic that we never repay in kind. It is never sin for sin. 1 Peter 3, 9. Not returning. Greek preposition anti, called a preposition of exchange. Not exchanging evil for evil or exchanging insult for insult, but, and isn't the same as Jesus on the Sermon on the Mount said, but giving a blessing instead, for you were called for the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing. So the first idea, when sinned against, we never repay in kind. Two, love always does what is best for the other person. It always does what is best for another. And we ought to also add to that, it is willing to do what is best for another, irrespective of what it costs us. So the emphasis is their good, God's glory, in the context. Third, an action of love must never confirm evil action. Now, here's where we have to guide very carefully. We do not repay sin for sin. On the other hand, love never, and I'll finish the sentence here, never confirms evil actions. Let me give you an example. I want you to think for just a moment. Example. Let's suppose you are physically assaulted, beaten, or let's make it a member of your family is physically assaulted and they're beaten and the perpetrator is arrested. What would love do? File charges or not file charges? The typical sentimentality would say, oh, well, we forgive as Christians, and in forgiving, we would not file charges. Well, how would you feel if you failed to file charges and the person went out and did the same thing to someone else? What have you done? Have you not taught him you can get by with it? And we'll smile and say, we're Christians and we forgive you, and we'll, oh, is that love? Or would love say, we will insist on signing a complaint, we will testify against you, and we will pray that the judge soaks it to you for everything you've got, so maybe you won't do it again? And what is that? Could that possibly be the best thing for him? Certainly could, couldn't it? Love never confirms evil action. Now, a second principle. First, that we wish and pray for those who mistreat you. The genuine hope of love, I think, would be saying that you have assaulted, I hope you get thrown in jail for it, and I hope you also become a Christian. Because becoming a Christian is the best for you, and for you to be stopped in your course of action is also best for you. And I realize in the 20th century mentality and sentimentality of Christian thought, that's hard to think of, but I think it is very logical and very important. Next, and this is the one that we all really, really don't like. Whoever hits you on the cheek, offer him the other also. Now that is kind of a, we'll just call it, this is the turn the other cheek. I remember in high school, a young man that I think probably in his sophomore year was a Christian, and his parents had taught him that if you're hit, you turn the other cheek. And I will never forget I remember his name, I will never forget the day that he was hit on the face and lost some teeth, and he turned the other cheek, literally, and lost the rest of them. Now, is that what the Lord is teaching? And I would say, first of all, that these words, and you know I'm a stickler for literal interpretation, these words are not to be meant literally. If they are meant literally, hits you on the right, turn the left. If that is what is meant, then we have to indict two people. Number one, we have to indict Paul because he was struck and he didn't turn the other cheek. And the other person we have to indict is who? Jesus, because he didn't turn the other cheek. Let me show you. And that's why I think we can say, first of all, this is not literal. Now, I don't mean it doesn't convey serious meaning, because it does. But I don't think he is simply saying, if you get hit on the right, invite the assaulter to hit you on the left. You may do that if you wish, but frankly, I have my way out and I'm going to take it. I don't think it's just a way out. I think it's an example that you have, first of all, by Jesus in John 18. See, one of the features of the teaching of Jesus was to get people to a position of good sense by stating an extreme. Your right eye offend you? What should you do to the left? Pluck it out. Now, that has, by the way, throughout church history been practiced in cases where, you know, someone did something and felt that they looked out of one eye and they saw and they tore out the other eye. That's been literally practiced. That is not what the Lord meant. That is part of his teaching, to teach a very strong position in order to say, do everything you can to correct the problem. And therefore, he says, I don't care what you have to do, do anything you have to do to correct the problem. And some of his expressions are that way, and I think this is one of them. For example, in John chapter 18, are we going to say in verses 22, 23 that Jesus was not consistent with what he taught in the Sermon on the Mount? He has spoken in verse 22 when he had said this. One of the officers standing by gave Jesus a blow, saying, is that the way you answered the high priest? And what did Jesus do? Said, here, hit the other side, as I taught. What does he do? Jesus answered, if I have spoken wrongly, bear witness of the wrong, but if rightly, why did you strike me? So notice the matter of fact, he points out the wrongness of it, doesn't he? You did the wrong thing. I was not accused. You hit me. That is wrong. Acts 23, verse 2. And Paul, looking intensely at the council, said, this is Acts 23, brethren, I live my life with a perfectly clear conscience before God up to this day. And the high priest Annas commanded those standing beside him to strike him on the mouth. What did Paul do? Paul said to him, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Did he not turn the other cheek? So what then is Jesus driving at then in the context? He is simply saying there is a principle. And the principle is aptly illustrated, which is love your enemies. And he does it by means of strong language. We ought to take some of those someday and trace them all out. Unless a man leaves father and mother and family, he cannot be my disciple. Does that mean break up families for the sake of following him? No. The emphasis there, he puts it very strong in order to make his point. We even have idioms in English like that. I was at a 7-Eleven about a week ago, and apparently the fellow that was apparently managing had said to someone in front of me that had done something. He said, "You come into this store again and I will beat you within an inch of your life." Well, he wasn't going to do that. But the strong language made a point. Wouldn't that make a point to you? And we often use strong language in order to make a point. And it's not a literal, you want someone out of your office? Why don't you go jump in the river? Well, that's not necessarily a genuine wish. Jump in the river means what? Go away. And it doesn't really mean anything more than go away. Sometimes. Okay. So the principle is then, love your enemies, and turning the other cheek simply means you have an attitude and a demeanor that shows one thing. I'm not vindictive. And that is the whole thrust. Now, we've got a good commentary on this, and let's take time to look at it. Romans 12. Romans 12. On the turning the cheek, the whole thrust through here, the turning the cheek, whoever takes what is yours, do not demand it back. Just as you want people to treat you, treat them. And I think our best commentary directed toward the church has to be Romans chapter 12, verses 17 through 21. Romans 12, 17 through 21 is a good commentary on this whole situation. Romans 12 says, "Never pay back evil to anyone. Respect what is in right in the sight of all men. If possible, as far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men." And let's begin by noticing, just listing a few things about the context. Number one, this is describing divine viewpoint reactions toward those who misuse us. Paul and the New Testament, it's such a realistic book. It doesn't come on with the drivel. Act in such a way so that everybody will love you. Act in such a way that you have no enemies. Look at verse 20. What does verse 20 assume? "But if your enemy is hungry, feed him." And so the Paul is saying there are certain reactions that you ought to have toward those that misuse us. And in turn, that has some assumptions. And let's just put assumption one and two of them. Number one, we will be mistreated in this life. That's not an if statement. We will be mistreated. And if we go through life with the expectation that everybody is going to like us, everybody is going to be fair, and if you're fair to them, they'll be fair to you, and if you do what you ought to do toward them, everybody will be nice to you. That's not true. It is reality that we will be mistreated in this life. Number two assumption. All men will not be our friends. All men will not be our friends. The first assumption has to do with actions toward us. Wrong things are going to happen. But there's going to be wrong attitudes also. All men will not be friends. Some will be enemies. And that's assumed in the context. And there's nothing wrong or unrealistic, as a matter of fact, if we haven't arrived at the point where you think that everybody likes you, then you're wrong. You have enemies. Every believer has enemies. And one of the things you learn in being realistic in life is that you're going to get mistreated. You're going to be cheated. You're going to be lied to. People lie to people. Businessmen lie to people. It happens all the time. And we, in reality, have enemies. And there's nothing sinful about that. That is simply a reality of life. Now, notice we said then that if we are mistreated, then we have to react to that. And if we have friends, don't have all friends, but we have some who are enemies, we've got to react to that. We have to respond. And therefore, I think a second thing we ought to put down is this. We ought to compare action and reaction. To compare and have in our minds the difference between action and reaction. What is the difference between action and reaction? First of all, an action can be planned. And therefore, an action can be totally hypocritical. I know I'm going to meet so-and-so at 4 today. They're coming through that door. They're going to say something. And I am going to plan in my mind that this is the way I'm going to fake it out. And therefore, an action can be planned. If it can be planned, it can also cover motives, can't it? I mean, there are plenty of times with all of us where we have to plan an action that covers a motive. I said good evening, and I really meant, okay, you've got the point. And therefore, an action. Reactions have a different characteristic. Reactions are quick. You can't plan them. If someone goes up and slaps you with a 2 before going out the door, you don't say, "Now let me sit down and consider what has happened, and I'll plan my action." No, you react just like that. A reaction is like putting your hand on a hot stove. You act before you think. And therefore, reactions tend not to lie. Actions tend to lie. Actions give themselves to the possibility of lying because they can be planned. Reactions usually tell the truth. They usually tell what was in the forefront of our mentality when whatever happened to us happened to us. Okay, let me give out of this passage what I think are 6 divine reactions that we are to follow. 5 reactions. 6 reactions. We've had the first. Never combat sin with sin. Never combat sin with sin. Now that's normal, that's natural, but again, 1 Peter 3:9 is do not give insult back for insult, and do not give sin back for sin. That simple, we are never to react by combating sin with sin. That is a given. Number 2, the ultimate aim of reaction is blessing. The ultimate aim of every reaction is blessing. That again is 1 Peter 3:9. Instead of sin for sin, insult for insult, we again give blessing. Ultimate aim of every reaction is blessing. 3. Reaction should align with responsibility. Reaction should align with responsibility. Here's what I mean with that. Men always have a responsibility to protect women. Therefore, you may have 2 sets of reaction. If you are assaulted, you might go one direction. But if she is assaulted, what is your responsibility? It is your responsibility to get in the fight and protect. See what I mean by reaction should align with responsibility? Like walking down with your girlfriend and someone steps out with an iron club and smacks her across the face, and you step forward as the man and say, "Sir, you're forgiven." That is not in line with your responsibility, because protection is part of your responsibility, and hopefully you should have been there to either take the blow or see that she didn't get hit like that, or if she is, to see that it doesn't get a second blow. To set aside and say, "Sweetheart, turn the other cheek," would invite justifiably that she give you the fingernail assault. So that would not be aligning with responsibility. Fourth, it is legitimate to react to wrongdoing. It is legitimate to react to wrong by seeking civil justice. It's legitimate to react to wrong by seeking civil justice. The best, and you can get example after that in the book of Acts, where Paul, for example, remember they're going to question him by scourging. They hit him, and he says, "Is it lawful for you to hit a Roman citizen?" Scared him to death, because it was not. And insisting on the civil justice, the rights that he had under Rome, he was perfectly in line. It is not wrong to seek justice by means of a civil way. And Paul gives example after example of that in his letters. Fifth, anger may be an appropriate response. Anger may be an appropriate response. Probably your best example, the Lord comes into the temple and he sees the money changers table and he says, "Fellas, you really shouldn't do this." Can you believe that when he overturned the table and the money went rolling across the courtroom of the temple, and he untied the oxen and let them loose, it had to be bedlam. And he was very calm. He said, "Would you help me lift the table?" I bet he didn't. I bet he took hold of that table and put it halfway across the courtroom floor. And when he caused bedlam, was that an inappropriate reaction? No, it wasn't. It was a very appropriate reaction. He says, "What are you doing? Making my father's house a den of thieves?" And he was mad. And I don't know whether you can picture Jesus with a red face and the veins in his neck sticking out, but they were. He was angry. And that was an appropriate response. Sometimes, and again, these are all judgment matters. Is anger the appropriate response? I take it had he not been angry there, he would have been justifying or condoning the way they were misusing the temple. So it can be. Six. Some reactions, well, really all of them do, but some reactions are special in the sense that you may need counsel from a fellow Christian. Why is it possible that you may need counsel from another believer? When you're wronged and mistreated, you get hot, don't you? And when you get hot, you don't think too well. And so it may be well that I'm really hot and I want to kill him. And you go to another believer who's not quite as hot as you are, and they say, "Now look, think of it this way. Consider this." And therefore, mature counsel from a fellow believer may be the very thing that is called for in terms of reaction. Now let's go back to Romans 12. And notice in verse 20, he comes to the positive side of things. "But if your enemy is hungry, feed him." Now, what does it mean to feed your enemies? What does it mean to feed one's enemies? It's clear from Paul's writings that this is what we are to do. Number one, to make this a little bit worse than it appears, simply feeding them, such as, here's $5, go down to Hayes and get a couple of hamburgers. Now you're fed and you're out of my hair. The word for feed, and there are a number of words for feed in Greek, the one that is used right here, of many that could be chosen, means, a very special word, it means to break into bite-sized pieces. To break into bite-sized pieces. And it means, I don't offer you bread. Please, let me butter it for you. And there's no way we can avoid that meaning of the word. Now, feeding the enemies has a result. And the result is expressed in terms of a metaphor of saying, when you do this, you are heaping coals, burning coals, on his head. Now, what does that mean? And there are several ways we can go. Does it mean you feed your enemies and glowing coals on your head would hurt? Let's face it, that's not pleasant. Why would feeding him be heaping coals on him? Does it mean you feed him and you stand by and hope that he dies of food poisoning? We'll eliminate that one. I don't know why that one ever came to my mind, but I saw a Christian once that did that. I saw him in the mirror. So what do the heaping coals mean? There are two possibilities. Number one, this feeding him is the most effective vengeance. That may be taken that way. That is the most effective vengeance. It fits. Coals on the head certainly could represent something very painful, couldn't it? Certainly could. It does represent something very painful. And therefore, you feed him and you heap coals on here. It's the best way to get vengeance. There's a second possibility, is that the coals represent the shame that will be produced. Almost equivalent to, you'll embarrass him. I did this to you and you turned around and you fed me. And I feel very badly about the way I treated you. It's like coals burning into my head, and the burning coals could represent shame. There's another possibility with that metaphor, is that that could represent the melting of his wrath. I don't see any reason why probably all three ideas are very much involved in that metaphor as it's spoken here in this particular context. Okay, back to Luke 6. Luke 6. And we come down to 32 through 35, which gives another principle. And it's simply this: love is manifested through treatment of enemies, not through treatment of friends. Boy, that's a twist, isn't it? Because we usually say that those that are friends, we love them, we care about them, and what we do for our friends shows we love them. And Jesus said, it is not what you do for your friends that exhibit love. It's what you do for your enemies that exhibits love. And that's a different twist, isn't it? We like to comfort ourselves and say we love our friends at church, we love our fellow Christians, and we do nice things for them. What do we do for the man who hates your guts? And Jesus is going to say, if you want to see a real manifestation of love, that's it. And that makes sense. Christ died for us while we were still, what? Sinners. and he shed his blood when we were enemies. I'm coming out of Romans chapter 5. And therefore, what is the manifestation of the love of Christ in Romans chapter? Well, look, keep it, your finger here. Look at that. It's a good passage. Romans 5. It's got the same principle in it. Romans 5. It's an illuminating passage on love. But God demonstrates his love toward us. That ought to alert us. What is real love? In that, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And that's a different turn. He did not die for friends. Verse 10. For if not after we were reformed or after we changed, but if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his Son. So notice the emphasis again is the same as that which Jesus gives in the Beatitude, is that love is measured by treatment of enemies, not treatment of friends. Well, that really gets down to where the rubber meets the road, doesn't it? When is the last example that any of us can produce of really acting in love and doing something good for someone who hates us? We like to pacify ourselves by saying, well, she gave me a cake and I gave her a cake and we really love one another. Well, sure. You give me something, I will love you too. But that's different. Take something away from me. Steal it from me. Then what is the mental attitude? And that's real love. Which I think draws a bottom line. We know very little about the kind of love that the Lord taught. Back to Luke 6. And this brings it down to the bottom line, where we've really been in Romans 5, is that true love is measured by its likeness to God's love. Be merciful, just like your Father is merciful. So true love and mercy is measured by his love and his mercy and is of the same kind. All right, now coming down to, and again, these verses essentially repeat themselves. Do not be judged, you will not be judged. Do not judge, you will not be judged. Do not condemn, you will not be condemned. Pardon, you will be pardoned. Given, it shall be given you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, they will pour into your lap. If I be your standard of measure, it will be measured to you in return. And so the emphasis again on that. Now, all of this is saying you are a very generous person. And under our observations tonight, let me put 2 points. Number one, some examples of stingy giving and its results. And then let's look at a few case histories of generous giving and its results. First of all, stingy giving and its results. Genesis chapter 13. And you can forget Luke for right now. We won't probably be back to it tonight. Just want to give some examples that reinforce this loving, generous attitude that the Lord has spoken about in this context. Stingy giving and its results. Example number one, Lot. Chapter 13, verse 10. The issue is between Abram and Lot. Somebody's got to choose, you know, some land. And the human direction that we would all go is if there's land out there and you're giving me a choice to choose the land, then I'm going to choose the land that is in my best interest, and I'm going to leave you with the thistles and the thorns. And that's the mentality of man. So Abram, verse 8, says to Lot, please let there be no strife between you and me, nor between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we're brothers. In other words, I don't want anything to disturb love. Is not the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If to the right, then I will go to the, if to the left, I will go to the right. Or if to the right, then I will go to the left. And Lot was a stingy giver. Lot thought only of himself. And it says, Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the valley of Jordan that was well watered everywhere. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as you go into Zoar. So Lot chose for himself all the valley of the Jordan, and Lot journeyed eastward. They separated each from the other. And if I can put it down to a bottom line, Lot chose what would please Lot the most, the beautiful, cultured, watered valleys. And essentially, Abraham got left with nothing but brush and stones. Well, Lot was stingy, but go over to chapter 14. Lot forgot a dimension. And the dimension that Lot forgot was it rains a lot, the land is fertile, the land is good for pastures, but he forgot something, the spiritual aspect. And would you believe it just so happened that the land which he chose, which was the best land, was marked for judgment? And you come to chapter 14. The attacking armies come down. They took Lot, verse 12, Abram's nephew and his possessions, and departed, for he was living in Sodom. He was living in a beautiful place that was fertile and everything else, but it was also the object of divine wrath. Abraham had the brushes, he had the stones, but he lived. Haggai, chapter 1. Let's get some good practice anyway. I'll sit down and give you 10 minutes to find Haggai. Easy. Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, third from the end of the New Old Testament. If you can't find the end of the Old Testament, find the book of Matthew, the beginning of the New, and turn left three blocks. Haggai. Are you saying I've had my Bible for 15 years and the pages of Zechariah are still stuck together? Haggai 1, 6. Speaking of the diminishing returns of being stingy, God says, "You have sown much," this is verse 6, "but harvest little. You eat, but there's not enough to be satisfied. You drink, but there's enough to become drunk. You put on clothing, but no one is warm enough. And he who earns wages to be put into a purse with holes." That's a beautiful metaphor, isn't it? Verse 9, "You look for much, but behold, it comes to nothing. When you bring it home, I blow it away. Why, declares the Lord of hosts, because of my house, which lies desolate, while each of you runs his own house." Everything is stingy and self-centered. You give nothing to the house of God. And consequently, you know what to do? Every time you make something for yourself, there's a law of returns. I punch a hole in your purse. Because your priorities are all screwed up. I guess that's not a good Hebrew idiom, but your priorities are all wrong. And he emphasizes that. Malachi chapter 1. That's the last book of the Old Testament. Malachi 1, 6 through 8. And again, it's the self-centered, stingy kind of life that's centered only on themselves. A son honors his father, a servant his master. You see, it's really true. Everything that we do that brings us joy at the moment, but does not put God first, always kills us in the end. It always bites. And that is the difference between the person who is short-sighted. If I get this and do this, it will make me happy now. But if it is not the will of God, it will kill you down the line. Now that's, I realize I'm talking to a wall, and most of us do not believe that because we're now people. We're happy now, feel good now kind of people. We all are. But the truth nonetheless remains that it always has a payback. And that which is contrary to the word of God that begins with a laugh always ends in tears. And consequently, you have Malachi chapter 1, 6 through 8. A son honors his father and a servant his master. Then if I am a father, where's my honor? You see the tenor of their lives. It honored everyone but God. And if I am a master, where is my respect? Says the Lord the host to you, O priests who despise my name, but you say, how have we despised your name? Again, inevitably, living in rebellion against God is rarely seen or rarely admitted. And it says, you're presenting defiled food on my altar, but you say, how have we defiled thee? In that you say the table of the Lord is to be despised, but when you present the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? In other words, you give me the old moth-eaten lamb, the one that can't see and you have to carry to the altar. And when you present the lame and the sick, they were obviously to give the unblemished and the best, but you give the lame and the sick, is it not evil? Why not offer it to your governor or offer it to your man? Would he be pleased with you, or would he receive you kindly? And what is the Lord simply saying? He says, you do everything for yourself and everything for everyone else. You give them all the best, but what do I get? I get nothing, and I'm displeased. And if there's anything that should be horrible in our thought, is there anything worse than to be the object of divine displeasure? And that's exactly what he's saying in this context. Well, let's turn it over to the other side of things. We've got other examples. We go on and on with that. Oh, stingy. Not sting giving, stingy giving. Stingy giving. Now, other side, generous giving. Generous giving and its results. And let's go back to Abraham and the Lot context, Genesis 13 again. And we looked at it from the standpoint of Lot. Now let's look at it from the standpoint of Abraham. Would you say that Abraham in this context is a pretty generous man? He knew Lot. Lot, he says, the whole land is out there. Take what you want. And that obviously is generosity on his part. And it's interesting when you come over to passages such as chapter 17, 4 through 6. He was generous in that which he gave. And look at the rewards. 17:4, as for me, speaking to Abraham, my covenant is with you, not Lot. And you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be called Abram, but your name shall be called Abraham, for I'll make you a father of a multitude of nations. I will make you exceeding fruitful. I will make nations of you, and kings come forth from you. I will establish my covenant between me and your descendants after you throughout their generations, for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your descendants after you. You got the bad end of the stick as far as the land is concerned, but I blessed those rocks, I blessed the dirt, and I blessed the desert, and I made it bloom for you. He was a generous giver. Try Hannah. She is a good example. 1 Samuel 1. 1 Samuel 1. Here Hannah could not have children. And down in verse 11 it says, she made a vow and said, O Lord of hosts, if thou indeed will look on the affliction of thy maidservant and remember me and not forget thy maidservant, but will give thy maidservant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life. He is yours. That is generous. Go over to chapter 3, verse 19. Chapter 3, verse 19. Her son's name was Samuel. And how would you like to have a son like this? She gave him up in order to get this. Samuel grew, and the Lord was with him, and let none of his words fail. And all Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh, because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. Here's a woman who gave up her son. She gained a prophet. She gained a man with whom the Lord walked. And I close with that which we've said so many times. He is no fool who gives up that which cannot be kept for that which cannot be lost. And that is the essence of Jesus' teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, and it's the essence of the illustrations we've given. Father, we're thankful tonight once again for your word. Help us to look at things from your perspective. The human perspective is so inborn in us. It's get all you can. Center life on yourself. Have your own way. Build your own resources. Build your own bank account. Do all of these things with ourselves as the center, and may we realize that all that we build around ourselves is irretrievably lost forever. And only that which is invested in your honor and your glory and the good of fellow believers and the salvation of men really counts. For this we give you thanks tonight in Christ's name. Amen.